Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, Kelly Jean Kelly, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
The last Monday in May is Memorial Day in the United States. The holiday officially honors people who died in military service while the country was at war. The end of May also marks the beginning of a less serious kind of war. It is one many living Americans fight each summer. It is a battle for and about the perfect lawn. That's right, the lawn, the grass around most American houses. Virginia Scott Jenkins is an expert on Americans' extreme interest in lawns. In fact, in her book on the issue, she calls it an obsession. She explains that in the minds of many Americans, the perfect lawn looks like a soft green carpet.
One height, one color, one type of grass, one consistency.
She notes that many Americans believe such a lawn does more than make a house or neighborhood look good.
An orderly front lawn is supposed to be representative of an orderly household. Good neighbors have good front lawns, and good citizens have good front lawns.
Lawns are so linked to American identity that they are part of some U.S. government buildings overseas. Jane Loeffler is an architectural historian. She notes that the design for the American Embassy in Berlin, Germany, for example, includes an outdoor area made to look like the beloved American lawn.
Lawns are not only a big deal for Americans, they are also big business. The Bloomberg News Service found that Americans spend about $40 billion every year on lawn care. They pay for lawn mowers to cut the grass and chemical fertilizers to make it grow. Many also pay other people to help keep their lawns thick and green. These things are all weapons in a war against natural forces that, in time, may make lawns look wild or brown. So one might ask, why do so many Americans fight such a war each summer? Lawn expert Virginia Scott Jenkins explains.
People have grown up believing that that's what it's supposed to look like because tremendous advertising campaigns and pressure from the lawn care industry, which is a multi-million dollar business.
She notes that lawns also show a person's social position.
You know how much money it takes and time and effort to grow a perfect front lawn.
A major reason why lawns are so much work is because they are completely man-made, she adds.
There's not anything natural about them.
Even the grass seed historically comes from Europe and Africa.
Of course, not everyone accepts traditional American lawn culture. In recent years, another front on the lawn war has formed. It is between people who want to control their lawns and those who want to let native plants grow naturally. In 2014, in an area of Virginia about 80 kilometers outside Washington, D.C., a couple entered into a legal fight with their neighborhood about their lawn. The couple's house is on about 2.2 hectares of land. They cut and care for the grass on part of that land, but they permit the rest to grow naturally into a meadow with tall grass and wildflowers. The couple, Michael and Sean Pugh, told the Washington Post newspaper that they enjoy watching the butterflies, birds, and deer that visit the meadow. But the Pughs are part of a homeowners association, a group that cares for and governs a neighborhood. The Homeowners Association, or HOA, makes and enforces rules about that area. One rule that is common among HOAs across the country is that members must keep their grass short and green. The Pughs HOA says their meadow violates this rule and is not fair to their neighbors. One concern is that the meadow can reduce the value of other people's homes in the area. People who sell property say a well-kept lawn is an important part of making a house attractive to buyers. Another concern is that the neighborhood will no longer feel pleasant or even safe to the people who already live there. But the Pughs and their supporters say meadows such as theirs add value because they are better for the environment. The native grasses have deep roots and can protect against flooding. And the wildflowers invite bees and butterflies, which help crops and other plants grow.
Activists in other places have made similar environmental arguments. They say the chemicals that feed and weed traditional lawns can hurt people and animals. They criticize the water waste involved in keeping lawns green, especially in places that face drought. They also note that some kinds of lawn mowers use gas and pollute the air. And they say that, in general, keeping lawns under control takes too much time and is a job that few homeowners really want to do. In answer to these arguments, some people have found other ways to use the area around their houses. They use plants that grow easily, or they put in vegetable gardens and fruit trees, or, like the Pughs, they permit nature to take over and hope their neighbors will come to accept a new definition of lawn. By the way, the Pughs case was never fully resolved. The HOA decided not to go to court, but HOA officials are also rewriting the rules so that no one else tries to grow a tall, wild meadow in a place where neighbors prefer a short, orderly lawn. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
Researchers have developed a new machine system that they say can detect lung cancer as well as or better than doctors. The system is powered by a deep learning algorithm that researchers from Google and Northwestern University created. Deep learning is a method of artificial intelligence, or AI, that teaches computers to learn by example. The system is explained in a study published in the journal Nature Medicine. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports lung cancer is the most common form of cancer across the world. The WHO estimates that each year, lung cancer results in about 1.7 million deaths. Lung cancer has one of the worst survival rates among all cancers. However, as is the case with most cancers, survival rates can be greatly improved when the disease is caught early. For many years, doctors have attempted to improve screening methods to detect lung cancer. The most common tool currently used is computed tomography, or CT. A CT scan uses X-rays and a computer to make detailed images of bones, organs, and other tissue inside the body. Doctors who are trained to study CT images of tissue examine the scans to look for evidence of cancer. The process can involve hundreds of images. The examination of CT scans to detect lung cancer has been shown to reduce death rates by 20 to 43%, the study said. But it also noted that the method also results in a high rate of false positive or false negative cancer diagnoses. The new deep learning system uses an algorithm and three-dimensional or 3D technology to examine the CT scans, Google reported on its website. The method works by learning how to detect signs of cancer from a large number of CT samples. The study reports the system was tested on 6,716 cases with known diagnoses in partnership with the National Cancer Institute. The system's overall success rate was 94.4%. When examining a CT scan for diagnosis, the deep learning model performed equal to or better than six radiologists, the study found. Radiologists specialize in medical imaging to diagnose disease. Google said in a statement, "We detected 5% more cancer cases while reducing false positive exams by more than 11% compared to unassisted radiologists in our study." Dr. Mozayar Edemadi is a professor of engineering at Northwestern University. He helped lead the research. He said the use of 3D technology marks a big step forward in the CT examination process. AI in 3D can be much more sensitive in its ability to detect early lung cancer than the human eye looking at 2D images, Etemadi said. He added, "This is technically 4D, because it is not only looking at one CT scan, but two, the current and prior scan, over time." Lily Peng is a product manager at Google's Brain AI Research Group. She spoke about the study's results during Google's I/O 2019 conference earlier this month. She noted that the deep learning system was able to identify very small signs of lung cancer that are difficult for humans to detect. Peng noted that the method can be especially helpful in predicting cancer in patients whose early scans do not show doctors signs of lung cancer, even though cancer might be present. In such a case, a one-year break between CT scans could mean the cancer could become very serious before being found on a second scan. "Our model was able to detect these early signs 1 year before the patient was actually diagnosed, Peng said. And that year could translate to an increased survival rate of 40% for patients like this. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941 was one of the most successful surprise attacks in the history of modern warfare. Japanese warships, including several aircraft carriers, crossed the Western Pacific to Hawaii without being seen. They launched their planes on a quiet Sunday morning and attacked the huge American naval and air base at Pearl Harbor.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war.
Many of the American military personnel were asleep or at church. They were totally unprepared for the attack. In fact, some people outside the base thought the Japanese planes must be new types of American aircraft on training flights. The sounds of guns and bombs soon showed how wrong they were. The Japanese planes sank or seriously damaged six powerful American battleships in just a few minutes. They killed more than 3,000 sailors. They destroyed or damaged half the American airplanes in Hawaii. American forces, caught by surprise, were unable to offer much of a fight. Japanese losses were very low. There was so much destruction at Pearl Harbor that officials in Washington did not immediately reveal the full details to the public. They were afraid that Americans might panic if they learned the truth about the loss of so much military power. The following day, President Franklin Roosevelt went to Congress to ask for a declaration of war against Japan.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. We will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
The Senate approved President Roosevelt's request without any opposition. In the House of Representatives, only one congressman objected to the declaration of war against Japan. Three days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. Congress reacted by declaring war on those two countries. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor ended the long American debate over whether to become involved in the Second World War. American politicians and citizens had argued for years about whether to remain neutral or to fight to help Britain and France and other friends. Japan's aggressive attack at Pearl Harbor united Americans in a common desire for military victory. It made Americans willing to do whatever was necessary to win the war. And it pushed America into a kind of world leadership that its people had never known before. President Roosevelt and his advisors had to make an important decision about how to fight the war. Would the United States fight Japan first, or Germany, or both at the same time? Japan's attack had brought America into the war, and it had severely damaged American military power. But Roosevelt decided not to strike back at Japan immediately. He would use most of his forces to fight Germany. There were several reasons for Roosevelt's decision. First, Germany already controlled much of Europe, as well as much of the Atlantic Ocean. Roosevelt considered this a direct threat, and he worried about possible German intervention in Latin America. Second, Germany was an advanced industrial nation. It had many scientists and engineers. Its factories were modern. Roosevelt was concerned that Germany might be able to develop deadly new weapons, such as an atomic bomb, if it was not stopped quickly. Third, Britain historically was one of America's closest allies, and the British people were united and fighting for their lives against Germany. This was not true in Asia. Japan's most important opponent was China. But China's fighting forces were weak and divided and could not offer strong opposition to the Japanese. Adolf Hitler's decision to break his non-aggression treaty with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and attack the Soviet Union made Roosevelt's choice final. The American president recognized that the Germans would have to fight on two fronts, in the West against Britain and in the East against Russia. He decided it was best to attack Germany while its forces were divided. So the United States sent most of its troops and supplies to Britain to join the fight against Germany. American military leaders hoped to attack Germany quickly by launching an attack across the English Channel. Stalin also supported this plan. Soviet forces were suffering terrible losses from the Nazi attack and wanted the British and Americans to fight the Germans on the West. However, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and other leaders opposed launching an invasion across the English Channel too quickly. They worried that such an invasion might fail while the Germans were still so strong, and they knew this would mean disaster. For this reason, British and American forces decided instead to attack the Italian and German troops occupying North Africa. British forces had been fighting the Italians and Germans in North Africa since late 1940.
They fought the Italians first in Egypt and Libya. British forces had successfully pushed the Italians across Libya. They killed more than 10,000 Italian troops and captured more than 130,000 prisoners. But the British success did not last long. Hitler sent one of his best commanders, General Erwin Rommel, to take command of the Italians. Rommel was brave and smart. He pushed the British back from Libya to the border with Egypt. And in a giant battle at Tobruk, he destroyed or captured more than 800 of Britain's 900 tanks. Rommel's progress threatened Egypt and the Suez Canal. So Britain and the United States moved quickly to send more troops and supplies to stop him. Slowly, British forces, led by General Bernard Montgomery, pushed Rommel and the Germans back to Tripoli in Libya. In November 1942, American and British forces, commanded by General Dwight Eisenhower, landed in Northwest Africa. They planned to attack Rommel from the west, while Montgomery attacked him from the east. But Rommel knew Eisenhower's troops had done little fighting before, so he attacked them quickly before they could launch their own attack. A major battle took place at Kasserine Pass in western Tunisia. American forces suffered heavy losses, but in the end, Rommel's attack failed. 3 months later, American forces joined with Montgomery's British troops to force the Germans in North Africa to surrender. The Battle of North Africa was over. The Allied forces of Britain and the United States had regained control of the southern Mediterranean Sea. They could now attack Hitler's forces in Europe from the south. The Allies wasted no time. They landed on the Italian island of Sicily in July of 1943. German tanks fought back, but the British and American forces moved ahead. Soon they captured Sicily's capital, Palermo, and within weeks they forced the German forces to leave Sicily for the Italian mainland. In late July, Italy's dictator, Benito Mussolini, was overthrown and placed in prison. The Germans rescued him and helped him establish a new government protected by German troops. But still, the Allies attacked. They crossed to the Italian mainland. The Germans fought hard, and for some time they prevented the Allied troops from breaking out of the coastal areas. The fighting grew bloodier. A fierce battle took place at Monte Cassino. Thousands of soldiers lost their lives. But slowly, the Allies advanced north through Italy. They captured Rome in June of 1944, and they forced the Germans back into the mountains of northern Italy. The Allies would not gain complete control of Italy until the end of the war, but they had succeeded in increasing their control of the Mediterranean and pushing back the Germans. One reason Hitler's forces were not stronger in Africa and Italy was because German armies also were fighting in Russia.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.